You're listening to Strictly Business Podcast with Lindsay Williams.
It's Wednesday, so it's time for Wayne on Wednesday. Wayne McCurry is a portfolio manager at FNB Wealth and Investment in Johannesburg. Wayne, just talking about you being a wealth manager, a money manager, there was a rather scathing article, interview, in the Financial Times over the weekend, which I was talking to Shapiro about yesterday, actually. And the interviewee was Charlie Munger, and he essentially said that Berkshire Hathaway had benefited from long-term low interest rates, mainly, and a perfect stock picking environment. I mean, he was sort of being a little bit self-deprecating there, because obviously there's more to it than that. But he said horrible things about Bitcoin. He said nasty things about money managers in general, calling them astrologers. And there was another word he used. So, yeah, I suppose when you're 99 and you're a multi-billionaire, you can say what you like.
Yes, I suppose. But I mean, this is one of the most talented investors in the world.
Yes.
Most successful investors in the world. At 99, given his track record, probably the most experienced investor in the world. So you got to take heed of what people like Charlie Munger say. Look, I've always maintained it. There's no such thing as an expert in investments, because you're trying to guess the future. And believe me, it is a guess, maybe an educated guess, but you're trying to guess the future based on knowledge, experience, feelings. So, you know, to me, and that's why another thing I always say,
yes,
is that there's only one free lunch in investments, and that's diversification. It's the only thing you get for free in investments, is if you run a well-balanced, diversified portfolio over time, and time is the big key, yeah, over long periods of time, you will probably never be devastated. Because the truth in investments, you know, and I think this is one of the big mistakes that investors and investment people like me, money managers like me make, is you're always trying to find the winners. The truth is investment is avoiding disasters. That's how you actually accumulate wealth over time, is you avoid being taken to the cleaners. And the easiest way to do that is to have a well-diversified portfolio.
Yes, I
agree. So don't try and pick all the winners and stuff like that. Just have a well-diversified portfolio and then sit on your hands and only really take big investment decisions during crisis times. And crisis times normally means you buy. So if there's a proper crisis going on somewhere, that's the only time shares and assets are truly cheap. And that's the time you should actually go out and buy.
Okay, well, there's a lot of people could say that South Africa is and has been for a while in a proper crisis, economically, politically, socially.
Yes.
Therefore, valuations are relatively attractive compared to, for example, its US peers. So now you should be mopping up South African stocks.
Yeah, the South African shares, yes. Our all shares, not all that cheap, but I mean, our all shares doesn't represent South Africa.
No.
Yeah, and I'm of that view. Look, we all know South Africa, and we all know the history of South Africa. And there have been many, many occasions over the last 30, 40, 50 years where you just want to throw in the towel and say South Africa's doomed and we're a failed state. And I see everyone now, this seems to be the latest buzzword, they're talking about a failed state.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I'm not of that opinion. Obviously, there are many, many things that make us seriously grumpy in South Africa. And we can relate 99% of those to the government not fulfilling their responsibilities as a government. But to come and say we're a failed state and you must just get out and take all of your money and go overseas is not the correct attitude. There is a price for everything, and I think the South African shares have got more bad news in them than the actual bad news that's out there. You know, people love, as I said earlier on, people love this idea of a failed state, okay? Because it catches headlines, you know, people, South Africans, and maybe everyone worldwide, but certainly South Africans definitively, like to complain about the country, their own country. You know, everything's gone to rack and ruin, you know. And if you think about it logically, I mean, we might be on a slippery slope, but compared to how was it, 8 years ago under ex-President Zuma, we were in a far worse state as a country than where we are now. I mean, the government has failed us in many, many, many respects, but we're a long, long way from a failed state. I mean, you can go to many other true failed states in the world to actually see what a failed state is. But, you know, as I said, maybe we're on the slippery slope. I don't know. Maybe the government's got to do things differently. But the point is, we'll still be around. Effectively, investment horizons aren't more than 5 to 10 years. You know, the share market normally, quite frankly, never looks much more than 2 years ahead, 2 or 3 years ahead. But the market doesn't take 50-year views. It just doesn't. It cannot see that far into the future. So it takes anywhere between 2 and, let's say, 8, 10-year view on the market. So if you think we're still going to be here in 10 years and that we will have electricity in 10 years and we will still have roads to drive on, et cetera, et cetera, then these shares are now cheap. Mm. We've been on the brink, been on the precipice, looking over the abyss, according to many, many people in South Africa, so many times. And you know what? We're still here. Now, we don't want to be, I mean, I've listened very carefully to the State of the Nation address, and our state president said, we are resilient people and we will overcome this. And I do believe that because you make a plan. You know, you just make a plan because otherwise things would truly be terrible. But I would rather you would stand up and say, we're not just resilient, that we're successful. And to be successful in South Africa, the government's got to do things better. Now, how that comes about, I don't know. But what I do know is, you know, the ANC Secretary General, which is a very, very powerful position in the country, you know, Ace Magashule is not there anymore. You know, so there has been some steps. And there's many, many other politicians from, let's call it, the ex-President Zuma camp, who just aren't around anymore. But, of course, our state president and the government machine have failed in many, many, many respects. But, you know, once again, to call us a failed state is just overstating. It's not. That's just grabbing headlines.
A lot of people will have a look at the same speech that you've just referred to, the State of the Nation address, and say, heard it all before. I've heard it. We're resilient people.
Yes, we're very
resilient people. Yeah. Of course, you come from good mining stock, good farming stock, and everything else. And so you will be resilient and you will make do. But what many people are now saying, and certainly the ones that are not fleeing the country, but elegantly leaving the country, are saying, I don't want to have to be resilient. I don't want to have to
be. Exactly. That's
I want
point.
To go somewhere
to
where I don't
I
have to be resilient and I can employ
and it's
my.
It's terrible that we can't. Look, you can still be successful in South Africa, make no mistake. You can still be very, very successful in South Africa. But look, not to change tack slightly, but maybe to change emphasis.
Yes.
Believe me, the mood of the country has deteriorated since the beginning of December with the stage 6 load shedding. Everyone is just seriously grumpy and justifiably so because you've got, I mean, like during working hours in stage 6, you've only got electricity about 50% of the time during your working hours. Okay, you've got a generator, you've got an inverter, you make it, costs you a fortune, but you make a plan, you make do. You know, we haven't, if you think about that logically, and coming back to this making a plan and resilience story, if you during stage 6 have only got electricity for half of your working day, our economy should be in a minus 5%, minus 10% recession. We're not. We're going to grow at zero this year, which is terrible. But it just shows you, you know, we're not in a minus 10 or a minus 5% GDP growth. You know, our rand's at 1830, 1820. It's been there many times before. We're at the bottom end of a commodity cycle. So rand weakness is nothing unusual at this stage of the commodity cycle. But, you know, to once again come back to the previous story we're talking about Charlie Munger, you know, when there is disaster and catastrophe out there and everyone is throwing the towel and things are just deteriorating and we're falling off a cliff, that's when you buy.
Okay, so we've established that now, Wayne. There's a couple of things I want to say. Yeah. One of the reasons that we haven't fallen off a cliff and gone to a negative GDP number consistently, in other words, being in recession, is because a lot of the bigger concerns, like big mining houses and big industrial companies, have their own power source. They have their own little countries. I mean, Harmony Gold Mining Company, I don't know if this is true, but maybe has its own power supply and doesn't have to worry about stage six or anything else. So that's why, and that's the resilience. But I tell you, the little restaurant round the corner from you, it can't do that. Can't live in isolation with its own little country, writes its own constitution and supplies its own electricity. And the other thing you said was, in 10 years' time, 5-10 years' time, there'll still be roads. And just a little anecdote there. On Tuesday, I was speaking to this chap about essentially a reintroduction of a certain exchange control, you know, the 10 million a year business. And I said, where are you talking to me from? It sounds a bit different to our normal chat. And he said, well, I'm in my parents' farm. I said, okay, what is it? He said, we've got a few cattle. Turns out he's got 1,500 cattle, which is quite a few cattle. But he tried to get back. It was somewhere in Mpumalanga. And he tried to get back to Pretoria, to his office in his home. And he couldn't. He drove along and there were tyres burning on the road and there were trucks blocking the road because of service delivery protests. Now, of all the things you should protest about, it's service delivery, because people have to walk a kilometre to a standpipe to go and get water. That is protestable, I think. And that, to me, is a failed state.
Yes. As I said, there are many, many aspects. We've still got a law. We've still got to get, let me give a definition of a failed state. Is when you've got armed militia roaming the streets, when you haven't got a criminal justice system and a law system at all, when you haven't got a functioning financial system, when communications collapse, you know, we are a long way from a failed state, in my view. Things obviously are not great yet, and obviously should be better, and we deserve better as taxpaying citizens, yeah? But you know, the whole failed state argument. I'll give you another example. Your friend, whoever you spoke to that had service delivery protests and tires burning.
Yes.
You far closer to it because it's your neighbor. What's happened in France recently? That's goddamn sight 10 times worse than the protests we see here in South Africa. We don't see anything like what's going on in France now. So these things happen worldwide. You couldn't get through Paris.
No, you couldn't.
You know, so these things happen worldwide.
Yes, they do. Unfortunately, most 90% of France works. This is a pensions issue. It's not the fact that somebody hasn't got water or electricity into their house, having been promised years and years.
My point is, these things happen. It doesn't just happen in South Africa. It happens worldwide.
I know. Britain's been racked by strikes the whole year. I mean, you know, people having operations cancelled because of the NHS nurses and junior doctors strikes and everything else. So, yes, of course, we know that. But we know also that it will calm down and they'll go back to normal. In South Africa, you can't say that.
I've got you.
And just the other thing you said, but talking about gangs, you know, a failed state is when gangs are roaming the streets. What about the construction mafia? Sorry, I'm playing devil's advocate here. What about the construction mafia? You're trying to put up a building and some chaps with automatic rifles come around and say, okay, you're going to have to pay if you want to continue building.
I have no exposure to the construction mafia. The exposure I've got is I'm a director of Emira Property Fund, which is an average size, small size property company. Now, nothing like the big guys, but we do maintenance. We've got our number of buildings. We do maintenance. We build buildings. And we've never had the construction mafia a problem, ever. So I'm just saying, I know it's there, but as a reasonably large player in the property field, and being involved with Emira now for, oh my goodness, 15, 18 years, I've never had that come up in any meeting that I've had with Emira. And we've built plenty of buildings. We've done plenty of maintenance. We have buildings countrywide. I've been to the Growth Point Property Fund annual presentation. I've been to Resilient annual presentation. I've been to many, many property companies, their representations to the investment industry and investment analysts. And I've never once heard the property mafia caused us a problem here or we lost profits there. So I don't know how big it is. And I know it's around. I clearly got that. But I'm just not sure whether this is pervasive over the complete property industry that you can't build a garage at your house without armed gangs coming to threaten you and to kill you. So, you know, I haven't experienced it, and I've have reasonable exposure to the property market.
Okay, and so it could be an exaggeration by a sensation, a press that is looking for an anti-South Africa sensational story, something like that. Could easily be. It could be an isolated incident. Maybe it's restricted to the Western Cape.
It is around, but it's not pervasive.
Right. Okay,
it's not every new building that's being built that you get armed gangs coming and you've got to pay them extortion money.
Oh, good. Okay, well, let's leave South Africa now. You're pro. Yeah. I was playing devil's advocate. I'm not anti, but I'm on the fence. I'm a fence sitter. Let's have a look at something slightly bigger now, and that's the US Federal Reserve. They started their meeting yesterday. They conclude their meeting sort of mid-evening our time, sort of South African time and Central European time. They've got a situation where they acted far too late. They didn't recognize. Everyone that's got a commodity index on their screen flashing away green knew that there was inflation coming. They didn't. Apparently, it was transitory. But anyway, it went up from, I don't know, 3% up to 10%. Let's round some numbers up or down here.
Yeah.
Now it's come back to 5%. So inflation has essentially halved in the world's largest economy. And at the same time, GDP, the latest print was 1.1% quarter on quarter. Not good enough. Housing market starting to cool off quite, not dramatically, but it's a steady decline of house prices. And the jobs market is the one. In surveys of big companies, they're not hiring anymore. In fact, they're shedding jobs, and jobless claims, which is a key indicator to many people, jobless claims are starting to rise. So we could go into a mild recession in the States. So, and we got PMI out this week, I think it is. What does the Fed do? Does it say, okay, we're slowing down, but on the other hand, we can't be sanguine. We can't be too complacent about inflation at 5%. What do you do tonight, Wayne?
Look, I think they're going to do a quarter. I think they'll do it, but I think they'll probably send quite strong messages to the market that this could be the peak.
Yeah.
They could be at the top now because, I mean, the PMI in the USA, not the PMI, the ISM came out.
Yes.
That's still below zero. Look, the big thing is actually wages. Inflation. Okay, let's take a step back. There's three big things on inflation. There's food inflation, housing, or this owner's equivalent rental story, and wages. Okay. Now, wages is a lagging indicator that will take time before it falls. But all you see in the newspapers now and see on TV and that is people are retrenching it. Big companies are retrenching. So the wages story will come down. There's no doubt about that. Then this owner's equivalent rental will take time to come down because effectively it's based on interest rates and mortgage bond repayments. And of course, over the last year, interest rates have only gone up. So the housing part of inflation will stay high until the year-on-year measurement either is flat or turns negative, then it falls quite dramatically. And food inflation is highly cyclical. You know, so I've still maintained, and I've maintained now for a very long time period, that inflation is going to fall in the second half of this year, and I think it's going to surprise people how quickly it falls.
Look at that oil price, Wayne.
It's not going to zero.
No, look at the oil price.
Look at the oil price.
It goes from 86, 87 when OPEC Plus met. It's now 72, 73. That is a massive influence on inflation. Okay, I know they look at core inflation, which strips out food and energy. But nonetheless, there's a chain of events that sort of fan out from a low oil price, I think.
I'm not this big fan of core inflation. Because headline inflation is what hits your pocket. Core inflation doesn't hit your pocket. You need energy and you need food. So core inflation is just a methodology of looking at the lesser cyclical part of the inflation basket. So the excluding food and oil for very good reasons, they're the most cyclical. And just as quickly as they go up, they can go down just as quickly. Remember the 72 and the oil, you're measuring with 120, 128. Last year,
I remember.
You know, inflation. I still think it's not going to 1%. It's not going to 0.5%, but I think it will come to within tolerable bands end of this year, beginning of next year, and in South Africa as well, it'll go back into tolerable bands.
I hope so. 7.1% is too high when growth is essentially going to be zero. So it's just simply not good enough. That gap must narrow
but
at some stage.
But there's one good thing, we're talking about a failed state in South Africa and all of this. Our Reserve Bank is not representative at all of a failed state. This is an incredibly credible institution, and they will do the right thing. All reserves banks, all reserve bank worldwide are behind the curve. They always are. They cannot be in front of the curve because they don't know what the curve is until it happens.
Yeah.
You know, so everyone worldwide is behind the curve. So you always say, yo, but you increased interest rates. Now 6 months later, you're cutting them. Why did you increase them? For very good reasons. So, and the good thing about our Central Reserve Bank and the U.S. Central Reserve is that inflation is truly enemy number one. Now, remember in South Africa, just to go back to South Africa quickly, all you heard was a few years ago, land expropriation without compensation. You don't even hear it mentioned anymore. It's just not even part of the conversation. You can go anywhere. You don't even hear it mentioned. Okay, but that at the time was going to be an absolute catastrophe for the country. It's not even mentioned anymore.
Good point.
You know, this nationalization of the Reserve Bank, that was also huge news. You don't even hear it mentioned anymore.
No.
They haven't changed the mandate of the Reserve Bank. You know, so I don't know. Maybe I'm too optimistic, but I like South Africa and I like living here.
I
still, with even with electricity and even with the water pipes bursting and even taking forever to get something out of the government or the provincial authorities or the municipal authorities, life's lacquer here and I enjoy it.
Very good. That's a really good thing to say. And you've managed to survive all these decades without too much trouble, Wayne, I would say. I mean, I don't know much about your life. I just know you grew up in Kimberley and your mother was a terrible cook. But other than that, I don't know very much.
Terrible cook.
Awful cook.
Awful cook. It was best when she didn't cook, but she was truly a lovely person, the life and soul of the party. Without getting too sentimental, you only truly miss your parents when they did. Not miss them, appreciate them.
Yeah, making me sentimental now. Okay, Wayne talked about the Reserve Banks always being behind the curve, never ahead of the curve. If they're ahead of the curve, people would complain. They're saying, why are you raising rates when inflation's only 3%? And they'll say, well, because we can see patterns going forward. But they never do that.
Look further,
My first proper job after university was with an advertising agency called Saatchi & Saatchi. I thought I was the bee's knees. It was a group interview, three or four of us. Mm. And I thought I made some great points and everything. I thought I did. And I got a letter from them saying, sorry, mate, you're not for us. And I thought, no, I'm not going to leave you here. I want some tips. I said, why did you fail me just for future interviews?
Yeah.
Give me an idea. And they said, because you're reactive rather than proactive. And so I'm a forerunner of the Reserve Banks, you see.
Mm.
Right, Wayne, let's talk about food now. We've had a deep and meaningful conversation.
I've got a very good food story.
Okay, I'll get my very bad food the way then. It's not about eating.
Good.
Okay, well, just listen to my my food supply chain story. As you know, at this time of year, it's goose egg laying season, you know. What's that Christmas song, the 12 Days of Christmas? Yeah, I think there's a certain amount of goose laying. Well, the goose have been laying in Zeeland, in the south of the Netherlands.
Mm.
This old couple, or rather retired couple, bought a poultry farm and they've got hens. They've got hens and roosters and they've got ducks and they've got geese and they've got turkeys. And this time of year, I go there about once a week and buy a couple of goose eggs. It's never been a problem. Now, they said, we can't do this anymore. I said, why not? They said, well, we've had 6 geese stolen in the last 2 weeks. And quite honestly, if we put them back, they're either going to be stolen or they're going to be eaten by foxes. No matter what we do, no matter what security we put up, the foxes get through and the thieves get through. Because a goose, you know, to certain people, is worth quite a bit of money. And the eggs are stolen as well.
Yep.
And so that's the end of it. So I'm having to buy duck eggs now. Duck eggs are lovely. Not quite the same as goose eggs, though. But anyway, that's my sad food story. I want to recap on last week with that sliced, what was that beef dish that the world's greatest rugby fan, your partner, was buying you? What was it
called? Beef stroganoff.
No. It was from a Chinese, Vietnamese restaurant or something.
Crispy beef.
Any good?
Oh, it's absolutely delicious.
Mm.
It's not cheap, but you can actually get two. You can eat two adults can eat off one helping.
Okay.
Oh, it is just too delicious. But that's not the good food story. I bought a whole lot of motor spares from an auction. Not last week, the week before, and I was moving. I probably bought. Well, you can measure what I bought in tons.
Really?
Not in, yeah, I bought tons. I had two-ton flatbed pickup trucks, you know, two-ton flatbed with 2 4-meter trailers. And we did, in total, 3 trips with the 2 trucks and the 2 trailers. Yeah,
from where to where, Wayne? Your warehouse.
Yeah, in Johannesburg. No, yeah, in Joburg.
Okay.
I used to actually, not to my warehouse. I had to rent a storage unit because there's not enough space in my warehouse. So I've rented a storage unit, which we can talk about at some stage. That's a fantastic business. The storage place I rented at has got 900 units, eh? 900.
What a business.
And I got the only open one. I got the only open one they had. Anyway, I'm talking about food. So I was touring. Yeah, in Joburg. I collected these spares in Joburg. And so I was following the other trucks. 2 of my mechanics were driving the 2 trucks, and I was in my car, and my friend John was in his bucky, and we were going off in a convoy. Hmm. And they took me through an area on a different road that I've been to the area many times because that's where the Honey Rock Motel is. So it's right on Bayers Nordia in Honeydew. But they took me on a little shortcut, and I drove past this building that had a restaurant on its roof. With a big, like, army tent over the top.
What sort of building was it?
Restaurant.
What sort of building was it?
A one-story little commercial building. Like, you know, like almost like a converted house that's now become a little regional. It's a house,
okay.
Essentially. And they put this restaurant up on the roof of this house. The downstairs also a restaurant. Where they cook, and there's a little table, but the actual restaurant's on the roof, and it's called Osrio, or something like that. I can't quite remember.
All right, I'll look it up.
But
yeah.
It's a Portuguese restaurant.
Oh, your favorite.
It's a real spot. It's a spot. It's got fake grass on the roof. You know, that plastic grass.
Mm.
And it's got tables and chairs with this army tent and a little pub. And I had, first of all, little squares of cooked corn. Like it's almost like mealy bread, but little squares. Delicious. I had hot peri-peri chicken livers.
As
which
you
were
do. Yeah.
Outstandingly hot. And then I ordered their prawns. Now, normally when you order prawns in a Portuguese place, you get them, you know, cut open, butterflied, and grilled, and then you have your peri-peri and your garlic sauce and your lemon butter sauce. And this one, they actually cooked it. I don't know, boiled it, cooked it in this very, very thick sauce with lots of bay leaves and lots of, obviously, herbs and spices. And I also asked for the hot. Now, the only difficulty was it was quite difficult to get the meat out of the shell because it wasn't grilled. But the taste was absolutely delicious.
Oh, that's your favorite,
and
isn't
it's
it?
A real, and it's this place is as good as the Honey Rock Motel, and it's as good as the Troyville, and it's as good as what's the other Sesco's. It is on par with all of those fine establishments.
What about La Perenia? How does that rank?
It was great.
What about La Perenia in the south? I think it's near...
La Perenia is good as well. I haven't been there for a long time. La Perenia is slightly different in that it's big.
Isn't it near Turfontein? Isn't it near Turfontein Racecourse?
For a very long time. Right next to Turfontein, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember coming from England in 1988, and the prawns that I had been used to were more like proper shrimps, almost like shrimps. The size of maggots, yeah. Or scampi or something like that. And Reuters took me to La Perenia to welcome me to the country. And I sat there, and these prawns came along. They were about the size of kittens. They were huge. I was absolutely blown away by this, and I fell in love with prawns ever since.
The pommies don't order prawns in England.
No, we don't.
They're shrimps.
Yeah,
order a shrimp cocktail rather. It's much tastier. But I went to the UK. I started traveling to the UK for business quite frequently in the sort of mid-90s around there. And we had the lunch now. The pommies love their sandwiches. Oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm. It was sandwich for lunch, and they had prawn sandwiches.
Yes,
so I thought, wow, it's going to be good. No, it was a bit bland.
Okay, well, the only good thing that comes out of Britain, it's not a prawn, it's a langoustine. The Scottish langoustine, 90% of it is exported to Spain. It's a big prawn, but with a crustier sort of outer skin sort of thing, but very, very delicious. Okay, of course, as usual, I'm now hungry, and I'm going to look through the delivery people
and see
which one has a prawns. I'll find a Portuguese place. That's what I'm going to do. Wayne, thanks very much for your time, as always. That's Wayne McCurry from FNB Wealth and Investment. And that was Wayne on Wednesday. The views and opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of Lindsay Williams and various contributors and do not reflect the policy, position, or opinion of any other agency, organization, employer, or company associated with strictlybusinesspodcast.com. Assumptions made on the analyses are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the speaker or the author. And since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to change, revision, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity.